So this is the weak on spectroscopy, and I will present not very new work. Actually, a lot of it is a few years old, but I think not many people are familiar with the work. I think the most recent achievements in this direction actually have been achieved by Ulf very recently, and he gave a talk on this on Friday. But I want to put this more in perspective and think how we which direction we should go if you want to go beyond the adiabatic local density approximations, and which problems do we face, and how are we going to improve our functionals. And the route that I will present here is to make a connection to many body perturbation theory effect. This is the only route I know. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't know how to go beyond ALDA if I wouldn't have the help of many body perturbation theory. Maybe some other people have ideas, but anyway, as Ulf has shown you last week, the approach has been very successful. I mean, there are some problems, but there are also some successes. He showed that his Poiket iteration scheme was very successful in getting good ground state potentials even. Also, the work in the nanoquantum network by many people, Lucia Reining, Andrea Marini, and so on, in devising this nanoquantum kernel has been quite successful in describing excitonic properties. So the direction of, or the idea of connecting to many-body perturbation theory has been quite fruitful, I would say. And this is of course not surprising, because in TDDFT we are after all trying to solve a many-body problem, albeit in a somewhat convoluted way, right? Okay, so I'll start with a very brief overview of time-dependent density functional theory and the current status, and then I will discuss the non-locality of the functionals in space and time and how they are connected, and then I will go over to the many-body approach to DDFT. And I will think a little bit, I will present a scheme along the same lines as Ulf on how to construct functionals that have memory effects and they have nice properties, like they satisfy some rules and so on. And then I will come with some conclusions and outlook after that. Okay, time-dependent density functional theory. Well, the heart of the theory is, I think it's, I mean, everybody using TDDFT is basically using the Kohn-Sham equations. And since we're doing time-dependent DFT, those are time-dependent equations, although they're often converted to linear response equations, but the essence of the matter is we have time-dependent Kohn-Sham equations. That means we have a time-dependent Kohn-Sham potential depending on the time-dependent density. And the whole strategy of the scheme is to we put the known external potential of the system that we're interested in, say the two nuclei of the H2 molecule or the silicon atoms in a silicon crystal at some spot, and then we run our scheme and we hope that our exchange correlation potential is really smart enough such that if you kick the system with the field, that it will produce the true time-dependent density. And if you have the true time-dependent density, we can do Fourier transforms and calculate, for instance, dipole moments and then an absorption spectra. Okay, so this is the idea of the scheme. And of course, everything depends on the quality of the approximation for VXC we make here. Okay, so as I said, many of these calculations are actually done in linear response, and the linear response equations are actually quite easily derived. I mean, the exchange correlation part of the potential is simply the part we get if we subtract out the external potential and the Hartree potential of the system, then we get the exchange correlation potential. And if I differentiate this with respect to the density, which I can do because it is a density functional, then I get what is defined to be the exchange correlation kernel. And it's a function of two positions and two times, but if you perturb a system which is initially in the ground state, then it's only a function of the time difference. Okay, so if I take this derivative with respect to the density, I have to take this derivative with respect to the density, that one. And that one, well, this is easy because it's the Hartree potential. We know how it looks like. It gives you this. And these two objects are essentially the inverse the Kohn-Sham response function. So the change in density, if I change the density in the Kohn-Sham, change the potential in the Kohn-Sham equations, and the true density response function. So this is chi s inverse, and this is chi inverse. Now we can multiply with this chi on both sides, and we get an equation, and that's this equation. So it's derived in a few lines. So we have that the true density response function is given by the Cohn-Sham density response function plus an extra term, which involves again the Cohn-Sham density response function, the two-particle interaction, this FXC kernel, and the true chi again. So this, for a given approximation for VXC, that means that we have a given approximation for FXC, this is an equation for the chi itself, because also the chi S I can express directly in terms of the Cohn-Sham orbitals. So, and those I know as soon as I've chosen a VXC. Now, this equation is used often to calculate excitation energies of the system. And why is that? Well, it's because as soon as you know this function, then from the poles in frequency space, we can actually extract the excitation energies of the system. Now, chi s is the response function also of a system, but it's a non-interacting system, and its poles correspond to the excitation energies of this non-interacting system. And since this non-interacting system is simply the Cohn-Sham system, the poles are actually given by differences in Cohn-Sham eigenvalues. Another way of viewing this is that the poles consist of or the excitations in the Cohn-Sham system included in chi s, they consist simply of excited states that would correspond to singly excited Slater determinants. Okay. Of course, the true many-body states, I mean, if you think about this in terms of a CI expansion, involve many more states than just singly excited Slater determinants. So this means that this response function will have additional poles compared to this one on this wave function level here. And those poles, they correspond, say, to doubly excited states, or they could correspond, say, maybe to excitonic states, and so on. And so how do we get these poles in chi? If we only have poles in chi s, well, they must be generated by the FXC. So the FXC must have a frequency dependence to generate the extra poles. And frequency dependence immediately means memory, because if you go back to real time, frequency dependence means memory. So the memory in exchange correlation potential contains, in fact, the physics of the double and the higher excitations, and maybe also excitonic effects and many other effects. So to generate this extra pulse, we have to look at frequency dependence in FXC, and that means going beyond the adiabatic approximation. And I think this is one of the important important goals for people trying to develop functionals beyond ALDA. Not only important for spectroscopy, but also important for things like quantum transport. Yes, that's true. But you can already see that static FXC already shifts the poles. The question is if it can shift it to the right position. But I mean, even that is, you probably need the frequency dependence to get that correct for all the poles. Okay, so now I go to the discussion of some functionals. So historically, the first approximation used was the adiabatic local density approximation, and this is an extremely simple approximation. The only thing you say is that I take the familiar expression from the electron gas, the exchange correlation energy density per particle of the electron gas, and I plug in not just the density of R, like you do in Gransset DFT, but I plug the density of R and T. And this means that the potential at time r, at position r and time t, depends directly on the density at those two points. So you can say there is no memory in the system. And this you can see immediately from the FXC, because if you now take the derivative with respect to the density, I get these two delta functions here. So this describes the locality in space, and this describes the locality in time. So the adiabatic local density approximation is both local in space and in time. And these are defined by the FXC. So this is what I define to be local. Okay, so then how to go to beyond the ALDA? One of the first people that tried to go beyond the LDA was Hardy Gross in collaboration with Walter Cohn. And what they said, why don't we take the FXC of the electron gas, but we don't make the approximation that it's local in time. We take the frequency dependence of the electron gas, and then we keep the delta function here. And however, it turned out that this functionals violates some basic conservation laws. And this was heavily discussed by people like John Dobson and by Giovanni Vignale. And also the reason for this was actually pinpointed by Vignale and Dobson. So let us now go to the reason for this violation of the conservation laws. So an important conservation law in DFT is the momentum conservation in the system. So and this relates to what is called the zero force theorem. And the zero force theorem tells you that the force exerted on the system by the exchange correlation potential, which is given by this expression, is zero. And this is not hard to imagine, because the exchange correlation effect are an internal effect of the system. And they would not, I mean, the exchange correlation potential or exchange correlation force would not accelerate the system. If it would, that would be very strange. Okay. And this is actually quite easy to show that this is the case. And this relation is, in fact, satisfied by the adiabatic local density approximation, but it is actually not, in general, satisfied for approximate potentials. Commonly used approximation is, for instance, the KLI approximation, which is a simplification of what is called the time-dependent OEP scheme. It does violate it, and also the Gross-Cohn violates it. Actually, I have some nice examples. These are pictures from the PhD thesis of Michael Mund, who did his PhD with Stefan Kümmel. And he calculated, for instance, the time derivative of the momentum for a sodium 5 cluster. And he did this in the time-dependent KLI approximation. Now, the momentum due to the external potential should be equal to the momentum due to the external and exchange potential, because this one should cancel out due to the zero force theorem. And if you do the calculation, you see it does not. In fact, the system starts to self-excite itself, and it starts to move more and more violently. So if you tickle the system, it starts to vibrate, and it starts to vibrate more and more and more, and then it goes crazy.
The red curve is smaller than the blue curve.
Yes, but it's not the same. Okay, so this is probably excited with some laser. So this, let's say, I don't remember which case is what. He has two cases. Maybe it was this case. Yeah. So he has two cases. One, he simply excites with some laser and see what happens. And one case when he simply tickles the system with a little perturbation and see what happens. So actually, I have not looked up. But you can find actually all the several more examples in this paper in FISRF A.
But what I meant was, sorry, Phil.
Go ahead.
I just meant on the right that yes. Your verbal description, it's more a matter of self de-exciting, self damping,
yes.
Rather than self
exciting. Yeah, in this case, it's more, yeah, that's right, that's right. And in this case, it's more like self exciting, that's right.
So, Robert? I'm in danger of getting a little lost. It would really help if I understood what some of these acronyms are. So, KLI?
Yes, okay, I have not explained what the functional is. And actually, what it is it's an approximation you get from this DDOEP equations. Also,
that's another one. I asked last week, yes. Somebody told me, but they didn't tell me what O, E, and P were.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm laughing. And this is why it's good to talk here, because they're not only DFT guys here. So OEP stands for Optimized Effective Potential Model. So what you do in that case, you take a slater determinant, and you minimize the energy for the ground state OEP. But if you would minimize the energy of the expectation value of a slater determinant with respect to the orbitals, you would get the Hartree-Fock equations, right? So if you would minimize the energy under the extra constraint that the potential that generates the orbitals be local, then you would get what is called the exchange-only OEP, optimized effective potential method.
That's an optimum
It's a minimization under a constraint.
Say you wrote the 1/3 something.
No. It's you take exactly the Hartree-Fock expression for the energy. You minimize, but you put a constraint, and the constraint is that the potential that generates the orbitals be local.
It's exactly the same as exact exchange DFT.
Yes, exact exchange DFT. So this was the case that was discussed.
The local potential.
Yes, that minimizes.
Put into the DFT equations and gives you exactly the same result you would have gotten from Hartree-Fock.
No. You can view it. One way to view it is, I take a potential in the Cohn-Chiham equations, I solve for the orbitals, and I plug it in the Hartree-Fock energy expression. And now I do this for many potentials, and I pick the potentials that give you the lowest energy. And that potential is the optimized effective potential. Now this you can also do in time dependent DFT, except instead of the energy you have an action. So you make the action stationary with respect to this potential.
So it gives me the same wave functions that I would have gotten if I had done Hartree-Fock.
Well, the wave function is a slater determinant, but the orbitals that go in are slightly different. Because you put a constraint. So in particular, for instance, for the electron gas, that's I think the biggest difference. For the electron gas, you get a k² dispersion relation because you have a local potential. Whereas for the Hartree-Fock, you will get this derivative, this continuity on the Fermi surface. This is a difference.
And KLI?
And KLI is a simplification because if you work out the equations for this optimized potential, it leads you to an integral equation with some terms. And if you neglect one of the nasty terms, you get an approximation that is called KLI. So it's a simplification of that scheme.
Is it Krieger-Lee?
It stands for Krieger-Lee and Jafrati. So these are the three guys that were involved in this approximation.
So let me just mention that. So this is Joe Krieger and those guys in the, I guess, mid-80s, mid-90s, or maybe early-80s, spent a long, long time demonstrating that these equations were solvable in this approximation and showing all the good properties of exact exchange DFT with that little approximation.
Yes.
And then it took off after about 10 or 12 years.
So the main reason that it was rather popular is that to solve the KLI equations is much simpler than these OEP equations. And it gave very results that were very close, at least for the atoms they tested. So then people have been using it also in time-dependent DFT. But since you make this approximation, you violate some constraints. And one of the constraints you violate is this zero-force theorem. And one of the consequences is this disagreement, this self-excitation or de-excitation.
Can you comment a bit more on how close OEP is to Hartree-Fock? I mean, in the molecular world, at least, it seems that there's little difference.
For ground state, there's very, very little difference, but it has not been explored at all so much for the time-dependent case. And I think if you now look at, say, polarizabilities of long molecular change, you actually can see sizable differences between OEP and KLI.
I think generally the spun electron eigenvalues differ much more than the total energy.
Yes.
Which suggests that when you move to time-dependent cases, there's going to be more difference.
Yes, and you can also expect maybe blow up of the differences in time if you... This has not much been explored, but in any case, it's all exchange only, most of it, and actually we don't like exchange. I mean, we like correlation, right? So yeah.
Well, as you know, we've also done many time-dependent KLI calculations, and we've actually never observed these numerical instabilities. I mean, I completely believe what you're saying, that you know the zero force is not satisfying. But what is special about this sodium 5 cluster, and why does it show up? I can think of two reasons. Number one being you just propagate much longer than we ever did.
Yes.
And number two is that this sodium 5 is such a soft system or weakly bound system that you wouldn't see these effects if you had something that's a bit more confined. So for instance, if you put your electrons in a deep quantum well, or if you have a cluster that is ionized, so the electrons are more strongly bound.
Yeah, I don't know what the reason was, but in fact it was not only Michel Mont, well, the first one who found this in his calculation was P.G. Reinhardt from Nuremberg, and he has close contacts with Stefan Kümmel, and he found in his calculation that this happened. And then he asked Stefan, can you confirm this? And they confirmed it, so it was actually found in two different codes. And then Michel was wondering what is the cause of the problem, and then I happened to talk to him at the conference, and we kind of figured this out. It was related to the zero force theorem, and this is how I ended up on this paper. But I don't know much about the actual calculations, I must say. In any case, what you can see from the formulas, I mean, it's not, Michel tried for a long time, but it doesn't seem to be possible from the formulas to prove that it satisfies the zero force theorem. Where is this possible from the OEP equation? Okay, this was just an example, and I spent much more time than I wanted to spend on this example. Okay, I was, my idea was to spend like 20 seconds on this, but okay. So now, if you think about the zero force theorem, so if you differentiate this equation, I differentiate this equation with respect to the density, and you do a Fourier transform, then you can see that it gives you this equation. It gives you an equation for that relates fxc to vxc. And it's a funny equation, and the reason that it's funny is that this side here depends on the frequency, but the other side doesn't. So somehow, when you integrate all over space, this frequency dependence gets lost. And this already shows you a connection between non-locality and temporal properties. Now, much insight in this problem was gained by the work of Giovanni Vignale. And he had this nice example, which I really like, so I want to present it here. He says, suppose this fxc would have a short range, so like this, like it would decay, say, on the size of the exchange correlation hole of the system, something like this. And suppose I go to a very weakly inhomogeneous electron gas, so the density slowly changes in the electron gas. Then if this has a really short range, then I'm allowed to put this gradient of the density, I'm allowed to put it outside this integral. And if I do that, then this is nothing but fxc at k is zero for the electron gas. And then we know that this function is truly frequency dependent. So then we get the contradiction, the true contradiction. So you have something that is frequency dependent is equal to something that is not frequency dependent. So this means that the assumption I made was wrong. The assumption that I made that this has actually short range in space is wrong. And this means that non-locality in time is incompatible with locality in space. And this is the reason that the Gross-Cohn functional fails to give the conservation law. So memory functionals should be both non-local in space and in time. And this can also be understood from a physical picture. And this is a picture I stole from Karsten. He gave once a nice talk about this. And if you imagine that I have a slab of charge that moves back and forth, then I see that the density here doesn't change at all. I mean, if you look at the density, it's just what it is. The only thing that you will see is a current. But if you don't look at the current, then you see that the density does not change. But still, there is a dynamical process because the edges of the system move. So if you have a density functional that only depends on the density or its gradients, local gradients, then it cannot see the motion of the eternal slab. And this means that the density functional needs to have a long range to see the density charge at the edges. So this is kind of a physical background of this connection between long range and space.
Robert, against the original arguments of Giovanni, one has to be very careful about them because since the Van der Gross theorem has proven finite systems.
Well, this is a finite system.
Yes, but if you go back to Giovanni's arguments, they're uniform.
Yeah, but that doesn't change for this big slab. The only thing that would change is that instead of a very sharp K factor, you have a somewhat smeared out K factor. I mean, there is translational invariance.
I'm just saying the way.
Yeah, that's true. But this example shows that this, it's simply the case. Okay, so how to go beyond ALDA. So now we already know that if you want to go beyond ALDA, we need a non-local functional in time and in space, both the same. Okay, so then one idea is to connect to many-body methods. And why is this interesting or useful? One of the things is that it gives insight in how electron-electron interactions affect the properties of the tidal-band exchange correlation potential. So the non-locality and memory are directly incorporated in Green's functions, for instance. And another remark made by Matteo Gatti at a conference where I was, or it was a Benasque summer school meeting, where he gave a talk and he made an actually a remark which I found quite nice. He said that many body perturbation theory is easy, while TDDFT is simple. And what he means is that this is easy conceptually, and this is simple computationally. And so many body perturbation is indeed easy because the only thing you do is expanding the powers of the electron interactions, and then you do it in a clever way, you can sum diagrams, but this is the main idea, okay? The DFT has simple equations, but all the physics is kind of convoluted into the VXE, and it's a very implicit functional, and many people get very confused. So it's much harder to teach TDDFT, in my experience, than it's to teach many body perturbation theory. And so all the many-body physics is very implicit in TDDFT. Well, it's extremely explicit in many-body perturbation theory. So this explicit nature of many-body perturbation theory makes it easy to think about approximations that can be used and folded into a TDDFT. And I think the talk by Ulf last week is a very nice example of that. So in this way, you can then make explicit constructions of functionals which have nice properties like conserving approximations. So you need a many-body approach for time-dependent systems. And actually, last week I showed you a many-body approach for time-dependent systems, and it was called Geldisch theory, and I repeat it quickly in two slides. So I have a time-dependent many-body system with a two-particle interaction and a one-body potential which is time-dependent, included in the one-body part of the Hamiltonian. It's here. And I consider the case that before I switch on any field, the system is simply time independent, it's in its ground state, or it's in thermodynamic equilibrium. So then the ground state expectation values would then be, say, traces over the statistical operator if I do things at a finite temperature. And this is like an evolution operator in imaginary time, so I can actually write it for the time dependent case. I can write this is the e to the minus beta h again. And now I have this evolution operator that propagates a wave function from T0 to T. And so this is the Heisenberg representation of operator O. And this is the quantity one needs. And again, like I told you already last week, this can be viewed as a time-ordered product along this contour. Because I evolve from T0 to T, then I act with the operator. I evolve back to T0, then along the imaginary axis. So by defining everything in terms of time-ordered products, but then ordered along contours, I can actually do my standard many-body formalism as I'm used to. Okay, nothing changes. And one thing I can define in particular is an action functional. And the action functional is simply defined as the logarithm of the trace of the evolution operator where I now evolve from T0 along the contour back to T0 minus I beta. And then you would find, then now you may think why does this define an action? Well, if I evaluate this object for a static potential, so a static case, nothing changes, then this evolution operator is nothing but the exponent of beta times H0, the unperturbed Hamiltonian, which you recognize as the partition function of statistical mechanics. And this is then beta times the grand potential of statistical mechanics. So that means that in the zero temperature limit, this actually recovers simply the energy. So this, for the ground state system, this is actually nothing but the energy functional. And if you know from statistical mechanics, then this is a generating function for all your variables, all your statistical mechanical variables. And one of the variables is simply the density. So this means that this is simply a time-dependent generalization of that concept. It's a time-dependent generalization of the partition function of statistical mechanics. That's what it is. And it's a generating function of all your variables. In particular, if I take the derivative with respect to the time-dependent potential, I get the time-dependent density. This is not difficult to see. It just follows directly from the properties of the evolution operator. So the action is therefore a generating function for the density if one makes changes in the potential. And this is just the same as for the grand potential in statistical physics. Okay. Now, in statistical physics, people often make Legendre transforms. They go from one Flerbaum dynamic variable to another one. And I can do the same. And usually, this is usually done when you have a derivative. So you want to go from this variable to this new variable, which is given by the derivative. So this is a standard procedure in statistical physics, and it's done with something called a Legendre transform. So actually, I do the same here. So I define a density functional rather than a potential functional, because I started by defining a potential functional. So the density functional is defined to be minus this action that I defined plus this integral n times v, where I now regard v as a functional of n. And this is allowed because I know that there is still one-to-one correspondence from the Ruhmer-Gross theorem. Now this functional has the property that if I differentiate with respect to the density, then I can use the chain rule here, dA tilde dv dv dn plus v, and differentiate this respect to density, I get v, and I differentiate this one respect to the density, I get n dv dn. And I see that these terms, this dA dv was the density, this term and this term cancel, and I left with the potential. So this function has the property that dA dn is v. And this is, in a sense, the variational property of T to DFT. So this is a function of the density. Now, as an input, I plug in the known external potential of the system. So I want to study, say, H2 molecule in some field. I plug it in here. Then this is an expression depending on the density. So this gives me an equation, and out comes the density. Okay, so this is the variational principle of T to DFT. And of course, this requires in practice an approximation for this functional A of n. And now, one way to make our lives more easy is to go to a Kohn-Sham scheme and see how this looks like in terms of a Kohn-Sham language.
So is this another way of thinking about the Ruhmer-Gross?
Yes, yes, it is, yes. And the reason that I focus on the action, because the action incorporates all the symmetries of the system. So if I want to have the zero force theorem obeyed, for instance, I would like to have an action that is translationally invariant, because this implies, this is in fact nothing but Noether's theorem for Lagrangians. This implies then automatically that these conservation laws are obeyed. So this is why I concentrate on the action to derive functionals which have nice conserving properties. Okay, so what I did, I can also do for a non-interacting system. So nothing I used was particular to the interacting system. So I can have an evolution operator for a non-interacting system and regard it as a function of the V, which I call V of S, V single particle, V sham, whatever you want, and do the same construction. I have the A tilde dV is the density, and I can do the same. I can do exactly the same Legendre transform. So I have a functional for a non-interacting system. So if I have this, functional, then what I do, I define an AXC. AXC is defined by A of the effective one particle system minus the A of the full system, and I subtract out the Hartree term as usual in the EFT. Okay. And now if I differentiate this expression, then the derivative of this I call VXC. This derivative was in fact Vs. This is V and this is V Hartree. So what I get is that Vs is V plus V Hartree plus Vxc. And since this Vs was the potential for a non-interacting system with density n, we obtain the Kohn-Sham equations. So this is a derivation of the Kohn-Sham equations from an action principle. So I have a normal set of equations with VXC, and now this VXC is the AXC dN, and the variation principle works exactly the same way. I input now the known potential. These are all functions of the density. I solve this system of equations, and out comes the density. Okay. So now the crucial thing is, what is this AXC? So now I've just folded things further and further into the equations, as is very common in DFT. Okay. Now, to get more insight, I'm going to drive an equation which I like. And actually, it was already done by Poikert in 1978 using the Kaldish formalism, in fact. I'm going to make a connection to the time-dependent pair correlation function. And that's the standard trick of DFT. What I'm going to do is, again, write down this action functional, A tilde of V. But now I take this, I have a potential V of lambda, and I also multiply the two-particle interaction with lambda. And now for each lambda, I choose the potential in such a way that the density does not change. Okay, so the density is fixed. So the density at lambda is 1 is the same as the density at lambda is 0 for all lambdas. This, of course, requires a potential that I don't know how it looks like, but I will not need it in the derivation, how it looks like. Okay. Now, if I have this funny construction, I can say that A tilde at lambda is 1, and that's the action of the system of interest, that's the action of the true system, is the A at lambda is 0, which corresponds to the Kohn-Sham system, because I have a non-interacting system with the same density in that case, plus this integral d lambda of dA lambda d lambda. And this is an easy calculation, what it gives. So this gives you dV d lambda, and actually it gives you a term which involves the diagonal two-particle density matrix of the system. And since the density is independent of lambda, I can actually integrate this quite easily. It gives V minus Vs, and then I can go to the ANs, and then after one or two steps, I actually find an expression for AXC. AXC is given by the interaction, which is now also has a time-dependent delta function in there, times an integral over the lambda-dependent two-particle density matrix minus this Hartree term here. And this gives me this expression. So AXE is given by the interaction times two densities, and this is what is called the coupling constant average pair correlation function of the system. So the pair correlation function is defined as the diagonal two-particle density matrix divided by the product of the densities. And the G average means that I integrated all lambda. So this is a standard formula from ground state DFT, but it's perfectly valid in time-dependent DFT. And a nice thing about this expression is that it relates AXC directly to a quantity that I can interpret as due to electron correlations. This describes the interaction between two particles, the hole it creates, the exchange correlation hole. So it's a nice, I mean, investigating this function has turned out to be extremely fruitful in ground state DFT in developing new functionals. And I suspect this will be the same. The same will be true in time-dependent DFT. Now, if you differentiate this expression to get VXC, then you see this VXC has two terms. One term where I differentiate one of the densities in front, and I get this term. This turns out to have a long-range 1 over R behavior, and this is because the two-particle greens, the two-particle the pair correlation function satisfies a sum rule. So if I take one of these corners to infinity, I can take it out of the integral, and then this integrates to minus 1, and I get a long range 1 over R behavior. Okay, so if I pull an electron away from the system, it feels all the electrons that it leaves behind, essentially. Then there is a more complicated term that involves the derivative of the pair correlation function with respect to the density, and this turns out to be a short range and has a step structure. If you analyze this in ground state DFT, and this is actually something I did in my PhD thesis a long time ago, this is a paper from 1995, you see that these pieces correspond to, and this was, well, this is the beryllium atom, I think, one over R tail, and this part comes from this expression, has these typical steps. I don't think people have analyzed this in great detail in a time-dependent case. I think there is some work by Manfred Lein and Stefan Kümmel who looks at steps and time-dependent cases, but I think it's basically the same. Now,
what is this step, and where does it occur?
Well, it's a step. So the exchange correlation potential splits in two pieces. If you evaluate this piece, you see that it's a smooth function. And if you evaluate this piece, which I did in my PhD thesis, you see that for an atom, it involves this typical step structure where it jumps in every atomic shell. It jumps in every atomic shell. So it jumps whenever you go from say K to L shell and so on in atoms. And the same is true in molecules, in fact. And actually, Eva-Chan Barnes and Oleg Rutsenko have written many papers about this, and this would be a talk on itself. Now, okay, this is the connection I want to make. Now the efficacy. Okay, so you're interested in the efficacy, interdependent DFT. Well, the efficacy is a second derivative of the AXE. So if I take the second derivative, so differentiate VXE yet another time, I get a leading term, which is actually proportional to a delta function in time, so it's actually frequency independent if you Fourier transform, which is proportional to the paracorrelation function. Then I have more complicated terms, and these will in general all have a time dependence. So those will be memory terms, and those will be local terms. So you see that the time non-local part of the XE kernel is actually proportional to the paracorrelation function. This is very nice because this is a nice object which incorporates all the electron correlations. I can envision it as it's well known how it looks like, say, for the electron gas and for some other systems. So the time local part of the XE kernel is the average, so it is proportional to paracorrelation functions. And then I have these much more complicated terms, which has all the steps and even probably derivatives of steps, which consist of which build the time non-local part of the exchange correlation kernel. So all the frequency dependent and the memory are in these more complicated terms. So the question is how to get access to that.
What happens if I replace the G bar with the static paracorrelation function? Will I still get a memory in your formula?
Well, you have to think what it means, these derivatives. Okay, because these are formally time-dependent derivatives, so it depends if you do it before or after the differentiation, I guess. If you do it after differentiation, then this will be simply be a frequency dependent. Well, this will split, this is a Galois contour, it splits usually into a large and a lesser piece, and this becomes a retarded function. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to analyze this. Okay, so the only way to analyze this is actually do diagrammatics, and then you can actually see how this looks like.
There is a unique definition of the time local part, in the sense that, you know, like we could say, well, this piece is time local, and this is...
Yeah, the definition is that it's proportional to a delta function in time.
So then none of these other pieces can have a delta function.
That's right. If you go beyond exchange only.
Sorry?
If you go beyond exchange only, this is true. Because for two particles, in the exchange only case, this G is simply a constant, it's half, like for the helium atom, and then these cancel out. But not if you include correlations.
I'm sure the other terms are non-zero when T1 is equal to T2.
Yeah, they're certainly non-zero, but the question is if they're proportional to delta function in time. And the only case where this happens is for two particles in the exchange-only case.
I'm sorry, are you saying it does happen?
For two particles in the exchange-only case.
But they're non-zero and they're proportional to the delta function in time.
For two particles in the exchange-only case. But, if you turn on correlation, they're always non-local in time. Okay, so now I want to make the connection to many-body perturbation theory, because so far everything has been just a bunch of definitions and very abstract without any concrete things. So I want to make a connection to Penniman. So what I'm going to define is the green function. I talked about it last week in great detail for the transport, so I want to be much more brief here. So this is the green function. It consists of two pieces, propagation of a particle and propagation of a hole. And the one particle Green's function satisfies an equation of motion, which relates the Green's function to the self-energy, and the self-energy is a non-local operator, time non-local, space non-local operator, depending on the Green's function itself. So this is a self-consistency problem. And this object is usually defined diagrammatically. So you make an approximation diagrammatically, and you have a self-consistent set of equations, and you solve for the Green's function. So in this sense, it's in the same spirit as DFT. We have a VXE depending on the density. Once you specify it, it's a self-consistency problem. And then, but in this scheme, I have a great advantage. I have the advantage that I can make sure from the start that my approximations are conserving. So as soon as my self-energy can be written as a functional derivative of some functional phi, this has been proven by Baim, and I solve my equations, I will conserve all the basic conservationals: momentum, angular momentum, energy, particle number. And I listed already last week three conserving approximations. Hartree-Fock is one, second Born is one, GW is one, T-matrix is another one. But now I want to go to action functionals, because I have been talking about action functionals in DFT, so now I want to talk about action functionals in Green's function theory. Now, this has been studied by many people, and one of the first people to study it was Lutting and Ward in the 1960 paper. And here I wrote down one of the forms of the action functional, because they can be converted into one another using the Dyson equation. So this is what is called the Klein functional. And if I take the derivative of the, with respect to the Green's function, and require the function to be zero, then I actually get the Dyson equation. This is extremely easy to show, so that's why I show it for you. Remember, this phi is again this phi from Baim. This is Baim's functional. So I have this expression here. Okay, let's make a derivative with respect to the Green's function and put it to zero. So the a dg is zero. What do I get? I get d phi dg. The derivative of this thing gives me g inverse, and the derivative of that thing gives me g zero inverse. This was sigma. Now I multiply with the Green's function, I get this equation, and this equation is nothing but this equation. So this is the Dyson equation. So the variational point, or the point where this variation is zero, is exactly coincides with the Dyson equation, in which sigma is given by d phi dg. Okay, so this is it. There's nothing difficult about it. Okay, and now I go to a density functional scheme. So I use this in density functional scheme. And this is an idea that goes back to the efforts of Ulf and Carl Olof and me and several other people in Lund. And we have been working on this for several years, off and on, I would say. And the basic idea is now that one can plug in these functionals, it's variational. One can plug in Green functions that come from a system with a local potential. So I have a local potential, a non-interacting system with a local potential, and I can plug in such a Green's function. What I can now do is to look for the best potential. And the best with the best potential, I mean, I'm looking for the potential that gives you a stationary point of this action functional. So in the sense that if I do the a dv as is zero, I'm looking for the potential that actually satisfies this equation. And this is in fact what is called the optimized effective potential. So this is in fact the DFT scheme. So let's see what this gives as soon as I apply this to this Klein functional. So I have a g of s, and I have a g of s here. So everywhere there was a g, I plug in a g of s, and I make a variation with respect to the potential. So if I do that, I get this equation. If I work this out a little bit, what I find is this equation. I get an equation for VXE on this side, where this is the Kohn-Sham density response function. And on the other side, I have some self-energies, where the self-energies now depend on the Kohn-Sham Green's functions here. And this is a self-consistent scheme, because this response function on this side and all the self-energy terms on this side, they depend explicitly on the Kohn-Sham orbital, so they can be evaluated and this gives me a VXE, and this VXE I can plug into the Cohen-Chern equations to produce new orbitals. So this is really a self-consistency scheme for VXE, and this is actually the equation that was solved by Maria Helgren and Ulf last week in the talk.
So this is beyond exact exchange?
It's beyond exact exchange as soon as you choose your phi to beyond exact exchange. So this can be beyond exact exchange. That's up to you.
And if you're phi included all possible diagrams?
Then this would not be exact. It would not be exact because you vary on a restricted space. It would include correlations, but it would not give you the exact VXE in that case.
What would one need to improve?
Yes, and the Lotting Award scheme is one of those schemes. And I will come to that. So if you differentiate yet another time, you get an equation for the FXE. Well, this I did in the exchange only approximation, so I get this is now a 2-point function. And this is my chi zero, or the chi s, and this is a chi s on the other side. And this is just a bunch of diagrams expressed in the Cohen-Chern-Green's function. And those are the equations that were solved by Ulf and Maria for some atoms. So this is what it would give in exchange-only approximation. You can, of course, go beyond the exchange-only approximation. You can actually do GW within T to DFT. And then the same procedure leads to this equation. I have now an FXC because I have included correlations here. I get the same chi zeros on both sides. But now instead of the bare interactions, I have now the screened W interactions. And I have these two diagrams, which Wolf prefers to call the muscle strengthness. These diagrams. And you need to be strong to solve them. So, and this can also be turned, so this is now a DFT scheme. Now, if you do this, what would be the gain? Well, first of all, automatically the zero force and zero torque theorems of TDDT will be obeyed automatically from your scheme. Secondly, the density response functions you would calculate from these FXCs, they would satisfy important sum rules, like the frequency sum rule. And the correlation-induced memory, so the memory due to electron correlations, which is supposed to generate extra pulse in your density response function, is naturally included diagrammatically. So this is actually the main reason for using action functionals. The main reason for using action functionals is to derive functionals which satisfies nice properties, and they arise from the symmetries of the action. The action itself is not so interesting object. I mean, usually it's zero at the solution point, but the symmetries of the action, they are actually quite interesting. Okay, so far I discussed the Klein functional, and the main reason I discussed this one because it's the simplest to demonstrate things with, because it has a rather simple form. But I can use the Dyson equation to transform this equation into equivalent equation. So I mean, I can express G inverse in terms of G zero inverse and the self energy, for instance. So this would be equivalent. Lead to an equivalent functional if you would minimize it over the set of interacting Green's functions and not over non-interacting Green's functions, and it would be completely equivalent. And then I get what is called the Lotting Award functional. Okay, so this, as soon as you make full variations of the Green's function, it leads to an identical equation. The thing is, it will be different that if I insert Cohen-Chern-Green's function, if I insert a Cohen-Chern-Green's function here or here, it will lead to a different result. And to show you that the Lotting Award functional also leads to the Dyson equation, I simply make the variation with respect to the Green's function, delta G. I have an equation delta G sigma, and this is zero whenever this term is zero, which is the Dyson equation, and that term is zero, which is actually the Bain functional. So divided G is sigma. So the Klein and Lotting Award functionals are equivalent when evaluated for interacting Green's functions, but they are different when evaluated on a smaller domain. This is the thing. And if you, for instance, evaluate the Lotting Award functional at exchange-only level, this is just exchange-only level, do the same trick, but at exchange-only level, but in the Lotting Award, and you make the variation, then this is your equation for FXE. It's a much, much more complicated expression. Well, it looks more complicated, one thing, because it has many more diagrams on the right-hand side with double interaction lines, and also some some muscle strength-like diagrams here, where this bold line is actually the first iteration towards Hartree-Fock in the Green's function. So it's this Green's function. So you see that if I take two different functionals, both at exchange level, but I do the variations in two different functions, I get two different equations. Now this equation will not have the problems with the double poles that Ulf talked about last week, because there is a chi zero here, but now there is another response function on the other side, which will have the poles at a different place. So I think the general thing is that the more often you use the Dyson equation to go deeper and deeper into the functional, the more correlation you built in into your equations. Okay, so there is a hierarchy of functionals, and for each functional you can make an approximation for the phi, but then you can get for the same phi you can get different results. And actually, okay, this talk is supposed to be on spectroscopy. I showed you a brief result on how it actually works for total energies. So we actually tested this on some atoms and molecules, just to show that if you plug in an approximate Green's function, then the variational property guarantees you that the error in energy is only of second order in the error in the Green's function, because you're at a minimum. Okay. And this turns out to be true. We did actually some self-consistent calculation at second Born level with the Green's functions, and then we plug in Hartree-Fock or LDA Green's functions for these atoms, and we find that the total energies are basically on top of the self-consistent numbers with just simple Green's functions inserted. And the same is true at GW level. So we have here evaluated Lutting Award functional on the Hartree-Fock Green's function, for instance, for some atoms and molecules, and this is the completely self-consistent result, and the results are extremely close. So the variational property of the Lutting Award functional works very well, and the same is actually true for, we looked at, say, two electron removal energies, and the same quality applies to these energies. But these are, yes.
But these people go below the total energy?
Yeah, there is no proof that the functionals give you an upper bound or lower bound. Yes, that's right. It's perturbation theory, so it's like usual in perturbation theory. It's not a Rayleigh-Litz variational principle. You don't plug in a wave function, and you cannot rely on the Rayleigh-Litz variational principle. The only thing you can say is that it's variational. Okay, then here's some conclusions. So there is a clear need to go beyond the abelian approximations to describe a very physical phenomena, and I think this is one of the main tasks of people that want to go beyond there are many important phenomena in, say, in quantum chemistry with long range molecular chains and double excitation where this is needed. So there is a need to do that. Then, if you go beyond the LDA, then temporal non-locality also implies spatial non-locality in order to comply with basic conservation laws. And then, many body theory can actually then be used to derive such functionals which have nice properties, which are conserving, they have memory, and they have derivative discontinuities, and several nice properties. So this is a very nice feature of the variational schemes. So maybe we can, in the afternoon session, we can discuss whether this is the right way to go or not. Okay. And there's some outlook. So actually, we aim to test some of these functionals in quantum transport. We have not really been doing this very actively at the moment because we're too busy solving the Kanon-Bain equations. But we aim to test some of these functionals to see if they do work in quantum transport, and then Maria and Ulf, they have been exploring in detail these XC kernels that can be derived from the action formalism, and they found that the Klein functional can lead to some problems, particularly in the continuous spectrum of some atoms like beryllium. But they also have been very successful, if you use them in this, what Ulf calls the Poiket iteration scheme, to get a very good correlation energies and potentials and Van der Waals coefficients, and also the potentials, the correlation potentials have turned out to be of very good quality. So I think there is also a lot of good news in this. So I think this is, to end on a positive note, I think there is some promising work along these lines that can be pursued in the next few years. Okay, and then finally, I want to acknowledge some people. So the effort has been a collective effort of the Lund gang, as I would call it. So it has involves Ulf and Carl Ulf and Maria, Gianluca Stefanucci, Nils Erik Dana, Stefan Kurt and Claudio Fordozzi. All these people have had considerable contributions to this work, and has been so I'd like to thank them all for their nice teamwork. And with this, I thank you for your attention.
So Robert, I have one comment to the one statement in your conclusion. You mentioned that the non-locality in time, this is really implied non-locality in space for the conservational consideration, right? What's not very commonly emphasized also is the other way around. If you have a non-local potential, really you will have to have a time dependence. Namely, you will also need to have non-locality in time in order to conserve the conservation laws, which I think is for practical purpose is much more important, because many of the pseudo-potential people are using are non-local. Mm-hmm. And that, but it's instantaneous at the same time. If you plug that kind of non-local potential into a time-dependent framework, then you necessarily break the conservation law. There is no rescue for that. Mm-hmm. In other words, think about it. You have a particle that can move in time, and suddenly, at some point of time, you teleport from one space to the other point,
yes,
without any time delay.
Yes.
That necessarily breaks the conservation law.
Yes.
So it is very dangerous, especially considering from the conservation law point of view, to use any pseudo potential that is non-local.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about this.
This is a very important comment to make, but somehow people seem to be less aware of this statement, which I think is much more important for practical reasons.
Well, my statement was more like a historical statement, in the sense that Hardy Grolls first tried to do temporal non-locality and then bumped into this problem. But you're absolutely right, yeah. I mean, if you derive the continuity equation with the non-local potential, you see you generate an extra term that suddenly teleports particles.
Exactly. Right. All right, so I have one question concerning the Luttinger wave functional approach, the second part of the talk. Mm-hmm. Is it equivalent to matching the equation motion at the level of Schumpeter-like equation, like we discussed this briefly,
yes.
With Penkethoff's
this
is the same, right?
This is the same. So maybe I should write it on the blackboard. This is the equation of motion for the Green's function if you start from a Kohn-Sham Green's function. And then the usual approach is saying the density of the Green's function minus I is by definition the density of the Kohn-Sham Green's function. So this cancels out and you get an integral equation for Vxe. So you get Gs Vxe, G essentially, Gs sigma G. Now the simplest approach you can make, which is what is called sometimes the linearized Schumpeter, is by replacing the Green's function everywhere by Kohn-Sham Green's functions. And if I now differentiate, this is exactly the equation I can derive from the Planck function. Well, the other thing you can say, I leave the Green's function here, but I make a first iteration, I replace this Green's function, say, with this term. So this is using the Dyson equation once, the self-consistency. So then you get a more complicated equation on this side, and again equation for Vxe. So this is in the same spirit as floating the water in the Klein function. You use the reiteration of the Dyson equation once, and you get a different equation at a different level of correlation. So what you're saying is right. There's also the same you can do in the Shamsud equation, and it's essentially the equivalent procedure.
Is that the right way to think about why the Luttinger wall functional approach, in principle, actually following the Rex's earlier question, if you plug in all the diagrams, it gives you the exact VXC for the TD-DFT formalism?
Well, the Luttinger wall is also still not exact, because you have to go, you have to be doing this iteration many times using the diagram, then you will generate all diagrams.
But if you do it order by order matching, then in principle you get the exact expansion of VX.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, that's true.
But then you lose the connection with
DFT. You don't want to do just, but then you might as well just do many body theory.
What that means case, that this is course. The way to approach the exact VXC.
So now you would like to have the best of two worlds. You like to have a functional which is, it's already getting somewhat complicated, which is still relatively easy to calculate. With the nice insights from many body theory, like conserving and so on, this is actually your goal. So,
I just wanted to sort of make a comment for clarification. I think a few times it's come up now. I mean, the use of this word "local." There's at least two different uses. Sometimes being confused in the conversations that go on. So either in ground state or time-dependent DFT in the Cohn-Sham scheme, you have a single, I call it a multiplicative potential, a function of R and possibly of R and T in the time-dependent case. That's the Cohn-Sham potential that makes a set of orbitals reproduce the density of the many-body system. And so that typically has a highly non-local dependence on the density. So there's at least these two uses that get confused in that question. Because you can talk about adiabatic approximations in TD-DFT, which are local in time, but you're referring to approximations relative to, Cohn-Sham potentials, which Cohn-Sham potentials are always local in the multiplicative sense by construction. And so I think sometimes that needs to be a little more.
Well, I think it's easiestly defined simply from the FXC, because if your FXC is an integral kernel which is proportional to delta functions, then it must also, the VXC must have a, must be non-local in both senses, must be local in both senses in that case.
I just want to make.
Yes, but I think
the goal actually, since in many body theory.
Yeah, but I think the different the discussion is actually easiest at FXC level, because as soon as you have R minus R prime, T minus T prime times something, then you can talk about local. And also the VXC that generates this is local in both senses, both in the functional sense and the multiplicative operator sense in that case.
That doesn't quite address my point, which is...
No, I mean, you
my
should...
Point is the first of
the point is there are two words for different things. Yeah, okay.
And if you have an FXC, by definition, you're using multiplicative Cohn-Sham potentials and differentiation.
I would like to make a comment there in connection with the Shannon-Schluter equation. It was suggested a couple of years ago by Ilya Topshati to generate FXCs and BXCs from iterations of the Shannon-Schluter equation.
Yes.
And that's a perfectly well-defined scheme. It's a little bit difficult to do because the VXC also contains the E-squared parameter that you would like to expand. But you have a problem there because if you do it that way, you can do that in many different ways, of course, but you're not guaranteed to have the conserving properties that you do if you start from the functional and do that functional and use the iteration of the Dyson equation in that functional before you do the variation. Then you have the conserving properties guaranteed. If you just do iteration, it is not guaranteed. So that's a slight difference.
Mm.
But you're saying, if I understand what you mean, I could in principle take a conserving phi functional, and I can write self-energy using that functional.
Yes.
Then I use that self-energy and plug it to the Schamfeld-Leger equation, I can get the Vxc. Are you saying that that procedure, in principle, does not guarantee conservational at the Kangxiang side? You rather derive the Kangxiang part using the phi functional directly, and then control that the Vxc using the functional on the Kangxiang side. Is that what you're saying?
No. I said you can use the Schamfeld-Leger equation slightly tricky. Okay, using e squared, for instance, as a parameter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you will generate better approximations to the Vxc.
Oh, you just iterate more and more high order.
Yes.
Okay.
That's just a scheme proposed by Ilya Tokarev.
Right. There are two things to defy derivability, right? So the conservationals are implied, first of all, as you said, it must be phi derivable, but secondly, you have to solve your equation itself consistently.
Right.
And this is the thing where you can go wrong in the Tokarev scheme.
Right. I have a deep question. When quantum chemists sort of look at electronically excited states, say, of the benzene molecule,
yeah,
they use a wave function-based time-independent approach.
Yes.
First question, is there anything wrong with that from your perspective, because you always stress time dependence? And second, is there some density functional type theory that is time independent for excited states? Is there any sort of
possibility
to formulate it in that manner?
Oh, so the wave function method in a time independent way is perfectly valid, of course. You're looking at an eigenstate of the system, and that's time independent. And the question is, can you do something in TDD, in DFT? Well, this actually has been discussed before TDD-DFT became popular. Yeah. And this is called ensemble DFT, and particularly Hardy Gross has worked on this. Actually, he has worked on this here, actually, in Santa Barbara with Walter Korn. And then you get ensemble functionals. But then it turned out to be rather difficult to find the right ensemble functionals for that scheme. And then Ulf has been working on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
On excited states in DFT. And but maybe Ulf can explain it a bit better. And it was also before the DFT scheme. So you use some expansion in actually determinants, and then you have time dependent.
Well, that was a scheme how to address the problem where you have open shell systems.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the idea was an observation by Ivetan Bias. On how you would extract that, and I just put that on a more formal basis, so to speak. Because if you you would like to do the different multiple structures, for instance, and then you can end up in many different cases, you would have
sometimes more
terms than you can actually solve, and then you run into problems. So it's not a
But
scheme is going to work all the time.
Well, there's another marriage of DFT and multi-reference CI, which Stefan Grimmer proposed some years ago, which works very well in practice. It has the double counting problem, of course.
Yes.
And you do limited CI, basically. And you have to put in 3-4 empirical parameters that you calibrate once and for all. But then it works very well for medium-sized molecules, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder whether you would consider that a legitimate approach.
No, I think you raise a very important point, because I think the multi-reference problem is one of the big problems of DFT.
Mm-hmm.
Because you always work with a single slated determinant, and you make your life very difficult.
Yes.
Okay. So it makes perfect sense to start from a multi-reference configuration. Well, in ground state DFT, this is actually a problem, because by definition, the Cohen-Chiam system is that non-interacting system producing the same density, and that system is non-degenerate. You just have one determinant, right? In TDD DFT, actually, the situation is, in this respect, maybe somewhat nicer, because the Runge-Gross theorem allows you to start with any initial state. So that could even be a multi-reference state. I don't think this has been very much explored in TDD DFT.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly think this is very, very much worthwhile to explore.
But I mean, this DFT-MRC-I combination that is around has been benchmarked against many molecules, and it's superior to all sorts of standard TDD-DFT.
Yeah. I mean, you make your life very difficult by this one plate determinant, so.
To answer Walter's question, no, wouldn't have that's formally legitimate in the sense that it's doesn't work or isn't useful.
Okay. But it's legitimate in the TDD-DFT sense. Then it's legitimate, because the Runge-Gross theorem allows you to pick any initial state of your problem, including a multi-reference state.
Okay.
well, then you could say it doesn't account for the functional dependence.
No, you trade initial state dependence from memory. In that case, you get a different VXE because the VXE is also functional of the initial state. And the VXE has to be less clever in this case because you put already a lot of information in your initial state. So I think this is a nice way to go.
I didn't say it wasn't a nice way.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice way to go.
Most of the pathologies or difficulties that we know about in static DFT, such as the derivative discontinuities and the polarization dependence of the change, have the suggestion that they will be more severe in their impact when one moves to time-dependent problem. So is there anything from this approach to constructing functionals that shows where those effects are going to come in and how perhaps they can be reasonably approximated?
Well, if you talk about derivative discontinuities, I think they are most easily incorporated by going to orbital functionals. And I think the diagrammatics do that automatically as soon as you plug in g of s. So this is part of the problem. Whether they do it correctly is another matter, of course. And then that depends on which diagrams you include.
So the approach that you outline is intrinsically
in
orbital?
Yes, it's intrinsically orbital because your g of s, if I do it in time domain, it's something like 3 minus 2 prime, and it's some of the occupied orbits or something like 5 prime. And then you have. Yeah, so this is. There is no propagation. So the green function is an explicit function of the orbitals, always in this case. So the equations that Ulf solved last week on the FX, they were exactly of this form. So they incorporate the orbital structure. So the orbital structure kind of builds in the derivative discontinuities. So if this represents the atomic shells, for instance, then this jumps in the potential from one atomic shell to another one is simply because you include one more orbital in this one. Okay. And then the memory comes in as internal time integrals in the diagrams. So the ingredients are there. The question is if the ingredients are there in the right way. And that depends on the choice of diagrams. And this is of course an arbitrariness which is a bit tricky. But
speaking of this discontinuity, that reminds me of the question I still don't understand, and maybe you can shed some light on this. In the recent work of Weitao Yang, he made a point that when you have a fractional spin, like in a Mach insulator, or if you go to the dissociation limit, you actually find that the functional itself that we're using, for example, has to be explicitly discontinuous. In other words, he basically had to have an if statement somewhere. That's like, if it's this, then you have this functional. If it's that, then you have the other functional. And he claimed it's necessary to treat the fractional spin scenario. Which is very strange, because if you think about the finite derivable function, there is only one functional, there is no if statement there.
Yes.
All this can be come through the orbital and the time dependence of the object. Mm-hmm. So, but he claimed that because of this a fractional spin consideration, your functional has to be explicitly discontinuous, not implicitly discontinuous. Do you have any idea about that?
Well, I must say, I don't know the paper by Weitao Yang. I mean, so what you say is new to me, but so it's difficult to say what he means by that. If I look at it from a many body point of view, I don't see any. I mean, there is just one functional on it.
Yeah,
the discontinuities, they come in because you take orbital derivatives. This is what you can see from the OEP equation. So all the discontinuities are orbital derivatives. And of course, if you can, the calculations we have done was usually for spin-compensated systems. I guess for spin-open shell systems, then you have the different orbitals for different spins, and then you could have. There is also an orbital derivative for an up spin and down spin, so you get additional discontinuities due to spin. But they are essentially also due to orbital fillings. So I don't think I see anything new.
Loosely speaking, it's simply that he's making the point that if your formula is an explicit density functional,
going to have to face this fact. But as Robert said, if it's normal, functional, then the orbital dependence can take care of it. And he was, I mean, he's been exploring sort of if you have explicit density functionals, if you have explicit orbital functionals, and if you have other functionals, what does it mean in terms of how the derivative discontinuity shows up, in a sense? And that's all he's really doing.
Right, but still that doesn't answer my question. Take any of the functional discrete today, and then find the density functional counterpart of it. Right, you can always find a density functional, at least at a level of a formalism.
Implicitly.
Right, but there is no explicit discontinuity in that kind of function.
No, it's implicit.
Right, but he was making the point that it has to be explicit discontinuous as a density functional.
If you try to write it as directly, explicitly in terms of the density. Yes.
But where is that explicit dependence coming from? Does it because you wind up having jump between different minimum in the functional?
That's in the whole long story.
They should try look at Whitehouse paper, but I don't
know. We can continue this discussion in the afternoon, because I'm going to take this up again.
Yes.
Okay, excellent.
Good. So that's a natural place to break. So this afternoon we meet in the small seminar room at 2 for a general discussion. Anybody who wants to make any points related to the theoretical spectroscopy, that's fine. I hope that in particular we can focus on what are the guiding principles that tell us what is a good approach and what is a bad approach. And maybe people can express their views on what are the current good and bad ways to calculate things related to spectroscopy. If anybody who wants to show a few slides, that's absolutely fine. Either put it on the wiki or we'll bring them on your laptop
or stick.
Or stick. Yeah. And also we'll kick us off this afternoon with some ideas on guiding principles. So for the moment, let's have a look again.
Okay.